Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why one local harm reduction advocate sees hope and challenge in the opioid overdose crisis today. And what do Indigenous communities make of the massive land art projects that permanently mark the land? But first this morning, why would the military get involved in blocking a bipartisan housing bill in Arizona? That is the question our politics desk is asking this morning. And to understand it, let's take a trip back to last legislative session when a bipartisan group of Arizona lawmakers came together to pass a controversial bill aimed at easing the state's housing crisis. Dubbed the Arizona Starter Homes Act, it would have barred cities from rejecting housing developments for a host of reasons, like objections to aesthetic design. Proponents said it would have made starter homes more affordable for first-time buyers and increased the state's housing supply, which is far short of where it needs to be. But the cities didn't like it because it preempted local control, and they lobbied hard against the bill. Governor Katie Hobbs agreed and vetoed it, calling it a step too far. But there was one thing she cited in her veto letter that caught some reporters' attention. She cited the Department of Defense's concerns about the bill. They had contacted her office as the bill was on her desk, expressing their opposition. So why is the question? Cameron Sanchez with KJZZ's politics desk is here to explain. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with what Hobbs said in that veto letter. What were the DOD's concerns about this bill?
Well, in her veto letter, Hobbs was saying, I don't want to put, you know, military installations or fire public safety in any danger through a bill by, you know, allowing it to potentially encroach on their area. Now, of course, the proponents of the bill say that's a ridiculous concern because it doesn't do that. But that was definitely part of her reasoning. It was like the second paragraph of her veto letter dedicated to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unusual to see the Department of Defense, you know, come and stick its nose in Arizona state legislative politics and say, we don't like this particular bill.
Yeah.
You know, typically that's not what's on their radar.
Right, right. So now there's some new information out about this week. It came out, first reported from The Atlantic, and it found out who expressed basically the concerns to Hobbs and who asked them to do it. The sort of backstory here. Explain
yes.
what they found for
so
us.
So the whodunit has finally been solved.
Right.
And it's exactly who you thought it would be, which is the cities of, you know, Arizona who opposed these housing bills from the get-go and the Starter Homes Act in particular. And so it was the city of Glendale, apparently, who reached out to the DOD, according to the DOD. And they said, hey, this bill, the Arizona Starter Homes Act, would be a huge problem for us. And they cited, it looks like, the Luke Air Force military base mm-hmm. in Glendale and said, you know, this would encroach on that and it would be bad for the military and for public safety. And you guys should help us put a stop to it, essentially. And they did.
Okay. So why would Glendale ask the military to get involved here? Like, lots of cities, as you said, were concerned about the bill because of that preemption. How did Luke Air Force Base come into play here?
I think it was just something to cite. They also mentioned Yuma, but Glendale sending out the letter made sense because it's the home to that thing. And they had to have something. And the League of Cities and Towns is pretty well coordinated. They all came together and said, this is a priority in terms of, we need to get this thing killed.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to do it? And they did a lot of things to make sure that happened, but this was one of them.
So you reached out to the governor about this week. What did she have to say?
Well, the governor's spokesperson said they were not aware that Glendale had requested this from the Department of Defense. So I guess it had been a mystery for them as well as to, like, how this chain of events occurred.
Hmm. Have we ever seen reasoning like this used as a reason to object to these kinds of housing developments, housing regulations before, Cameron?
Sure. I mean, if you're opposed to it, you can find any good reason. And right now you're seeing the city of Scottsdale talking about how they're going to prevent other housing legislation from affecting them. So the state legislature and Hobbs worked together last year and actually did pass two housing bills.
Right.
And that was the Arizona Accessory Dwelling Units Bill. And the other one is the Missing Middle Bill, which allows for more duplexes, triplexes, et cetera, et cetera. So Scottsdale is now saying that they want to amend how they do zoning to prevent essentially those laws from being able to take effect in the vast majority of Scottsdale. And they've carved out this big section that's what they say is close to Sky Harbor. And I know that Sky Harbor's not in Scottsdale, but they're saying, oh, well, it's proximity to Sky Harbor still. And so we can't build these new types of affordable housing that are close to Sky Harbor within like several miles. And also there's a part of the bill that says HOAs don't have to implement. So in the parts of Scottsdale that are left out, it still wouldn't be able to go into effect there because of all the HOAs.
Okay, so similar reasoning, a little bit different. What did the Scottsdale mayor have to say about this? You spoke with him, right?
Yeah, we texted, and Mayor David Ortega was saying, well, you know, we don't like it, and we are all scrambling to figure out a way to deal with it. But no, they don't want it, and he said that it is an issue of zoning and preemption. He sees these bills as the legislature going too far and preempting cities from what's in their own right to do, which is their own kind of zoning and how they want to build housing or not build it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so looking at what the DOD did here, what Glendale asked, and now what's happening in Scottsdale, what did proponents of the Starter Homes Act have to say about why this bill was killed?
They weren't surprised, but they said it was a poison pill. So I talked to lobbyist Jake Hinman, who has been a proponent of all of these housing bills for the past few years at the state legislature, and he said, no, this is an excuse. And if Glendale had gotten some sort of language in the Arizona Starter Homes Act that said this doesn't apply to the Luke area, the military area, you know, that's totally safe from that, it wouldn't have gotten them on board because it was just an excuse to try to kill the bill. It wouldn't have gotten the League of Cities and Towns on board. It was a poison pill.
Hmm. I want to ask you one last question here in the last minute or so, Cameron, about the big picture. Like, are we seeing other cities right now try to stop these regulations from the bills that were passed, the kind of, you know, much less expansive bills that were passed, also arguing or trying to figure out ways to get out of this?
I expect so, yeah. And I expect that the Arizona Starter Homes Act or some version of it will come back at the ledge next year. Mm-hmm. So this is far from over.
All right, far from over. Cameron Sanchez with KJZZ's Politics Desk joining us. Cameron, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The town of Queen Creek recently approved an ordinance that prohibits taxpayer money from being spent on diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, trainings. The vote was unanimous, and supporters say it makes Queen Creek the first city or town in Arizona to take this step. The resolution requires the town to hire based on, quote, merit rather than affirmative action. Some council members also believe DEI trainings divide people. Supporters of DEI, though, argue it helps diverse groups of people understand each other and their different life experiences in a better and more productive way that benefits the entire workforce. Austin Vanderheiden is director of municipal affairs at the Goldwater Institute, which has been working to do away with publicly funded DEI programs. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, who asked what was the thinking behind getting Queen Creek to approve this ordinance?
Well, really what we saw is Queen Creek sent a message to their taxpayers that they're going to be focused on putting, you know, their hard-earned tax dollars to good use. They're going to put it and be focused on things like infrastructure, parks, public safety, the essentials of local government. They're going to hire based on merit, which they had already been doing, but really they're doubling down on that. And really they're defining what the role of local government is, and that's focusing on the essentials. And that's a welcome sight from our perspective.
Well, so I'm curious from a practical standpoint, as you say, Queen Creek was not doing these to begin with. So in terms of the actual ordinance, nothing really changes, right?
Yeah, there are a few things that that it does. It does double down, like you had mentioned, on what they're already doing, which is, you know, merit-based hiring, merit-based practices, things like that. But it also kind of protects taxpayer dollars and makes sure that they're not going to be spending it on things like hiring outside consultants to come and push some of these policies. And throughout the hiring practice, it changes a few things with you know, requiring people to sign on to kind of diversity statements as a condition of hiring, which we've seen at, you know, some public education, like Arizona State University required that, some of those types of things. So it really doesn't change much because, you know, those things weren't happening, but it just kind of prevents the town from doing so in the future.
In terms of the actual trainings themselves, are there cities or towns across the state that have been doing these kinds of trainings that you found problematic?
Yeah, so earlier in the year, we had seen Gilbert, Queen Creek's neighboring town, mandate unconscious bias training for all new hires. And really, again, we kind of talked about, you know, if there's the city and towns, they're kind of at a point where they're saying that, you know, their decreased budgets are due to things like, you know, the rental tax going away, and they're already kind of cash strapped. And so, you know, look at Gilbert, for example. They spent over $1 million on implementing some of these policies and these trainings, And so you look at then Queen Creek saying, you know, we're going to take that $1 million and put it towards things like parks, public safety infrastructure. And I think that's a welcome sight and something that, you know, potentially other towns could look at.
Is your problem, and maybe is Goldwater's problem with DEI trainings, is it more with the content? Is it with the using of taxpayer funds and the costs of it? Is it a combination of both of those?
Sure, it might be a combination of both, but I think in this specific case, you know, you're looking at a town saying, we're going to just strictly focus on the essentials of local government and put it towards, again, things like parks, public safety, infrastructure, whatever, you want to name. But to us, I think that that's a much better use of taxpayer dollars on focusing on some of these essentials than doing things like Gilbert had been doing, spending over $1 million on some of these types of trainings.
Do you buy into the argument that sometimes doing these kinds of trainings can make things run more efficiently? That if employees, for example, if coworkers sort of understand how each other thinks and, you know, what each other's experience is, like it makes the workplace a more harmonious one, a more efficient one, which could in theory save money?
Sure. And I think that there's ways to do some of those things without doing the trainings that they were doing. For example, unconscious bias training, you're teaching people that there's two separate types of people. There's the oppressed and the oppressor and things like that. And I don't really see how that's the role of town government. I don't really see how immediately dividing people is going to make things more harmonious. And so from our perspective, I think that there are other ways to do that. I think diversity is a great thing and it should be celebrated. But in the way that these towns have been doing it and in the dollars that was spent on doing it, I just don't think it was effective.
So if a city or town in Arizona wanted to achieve those goals, how would you advise that they go about doing it?
I'm not running a city or town, and so I don't have kind of that answer for you. But what I will say is I just think that kind of doing what Queen Creek did and say, you know, we're going to celebrate things like individual achievement. We're going to, you know, focus on the successes of every individual and provide quality for all. I think those are some of the more effective policies. And again, you're showing taxpayers that you're focused on spending their tax dollars in effective ways and in essential ways, especially at a time when so many cities are worried about cash and their spending power.
If there was some group that came in, let's say, and offered to do a free training, or if the city itself had, you know, developed or gotten sort of a free curriculum to do this, would that be less problematic to you if they weren't spending taxpayer dollars to send people to trainings or pay to have trainers come into the city or town?
Yeah, so there's already some trainings that are being really protected by the resolution that Queen Creek did, which, you know, some of them are like federal trainings that are required for police officers or firefighters. And so there are some of those types of trainings that are already taking place that are mandated by the federal government. And all of those are, you know, those are what, again, is acceptable through the city. It's more about the taxpayer dollars being spent on these types of things that is a little bit more objectionable.
In your mind, is it a worthwhile goal for cities and towns to try to figure out how to do these kinds of trainings without having to spend taxpayer money out? Like, for you, is it worth it to have the training, assuming that they can do it and not spend a ton of money doing it?
I think it's always important to make sure that everyone feels included and everyone feels heard. I definitely think that you need that in every sort of organization or team. And so I definitely agree with you on that. But what I don't agree with is spending taxpayer dollars on doing this. And when you're immediately dividing people again into those two kind of groups of the oppressed and oppressor, I don't see that as being an effective way to run any organization, let alone a publicly funded city or town.
So in terms of the content, though, and as you reference, you know, some of them are seen as dividing people. Is it a problem for people who have had maybe difficult experiences in their lives to be able to express those and have people who haven't undergone those maybe try to understand them so that everybody can try to figure out, okay, different people have different experiences. And, you know, for those who have had more unfortunate experiences, how can people who haven't maybe try to help prevent those from happening down the road?
Sure. And I also think that you know, you look at what Queen Creek did and what they discussed at their meeting, talking about, let's start to focus more on things that unite us. And what a better uniter than success or individual achievement. And let's congratulate people when they do a good job. Let's focus on the successes And I think that bringing people together and uniting people behind that kind of a common goal is also something that I noticed Queen Creek was focusing on. And I think we should do a lot more of that.
Are there other cities or towns in Arizona that Goldwater is working on to try to pass similar ordinances?
No, nothing in particular. I just think that Queen Creek decided to take it upon themselves to do this issue. And again, Goldwater's worked on this issue across the state and at public universities like Arizona State, but Queen Creek just decided to do this on their own.
All right. That is Austin Vanderhaden, Director of Municipal Affairs with the Goldwater Institute. Austin, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we uncover an architectural hidden gem in the valley as our series Last Resorts continues. But first, when Jay Alexandria Garcia was just 16 years old, she started experimenting with drugs.
I had experienced a really traumatic event, and after that traumatic event, I didn't necessarily have the types of resources that I needed to get any type of trauma therapy or assistance for that. So I turned to the one thing that I found that would help with that, and that was heroin and cocaine.
Mm. It took her more than a decade to get out of it, including several stints in Arizona's Department of Corrections, several rounds of anonymous programs until she finally got clean.
And it wasn't really until I had become engaged with types of organizations like Sonoran Prevention Works and Shot in the Dark. And organizations like that played a really instrumental role in me finding my footing mm-hmm. and understanding that this way that I had viewed substance use previously may not be the way that things really are. And by meeting them and learning more about harm reduction and getting access to the things that I needed in that time when I wasn't necessarily ready to get clean yet, played a huge role in my ability to, again, find my footing when I was ready to get clean.
Those are some of the leading harm reduction organizations in the state she named there that work to help people stay safe and alive while using drugs. For Garcia, it all led her to the work she does now with Arizonans for Transparency and Accountability in Corrections, DREAM.org, and the University of Arizona's Harm Reduction Lab. She wrote an opinion piece recently in the Arizona Republic calling for the state to spend more on overdose prevention and less on incarceration, diverting people away from the criminal justice system and into treatment that addresses the root causes of substance use disorder. It comes as there is some good news on this front. National public health data shows a dramatic drop in overdose deaths across the country. And here in Arizona, there is more money coming to the Department of Corrections from a sweeping $1.14 million settlement with opioid manufacturers and pharmacies to tackle the fallout from the opioid epidemic. Though it didn't come without controversy, Attorney General Chris Mays took Governor Katie Hobbs to court over diverting the funds to corrections, arguing they weren't meant to fill a hole in the state budget. For Garcia, it points to an opportunity and a challenge. I spoke with her more about it all and how her own story led her here.
Even after I got clean, it wasn't a simple journey. I continued to lose people very close to me to the overdose crisis. And that's really what led me into this work was understanding that I had gotten very lucky by making it out. Mm. And I was very lucky with the types of resources and connections that I had, and understanding that not everyone has that, but that everyone should. I wanted to be somebody who could help bring that information to the public, start working on policy, because I do have policy experience as well as experience in the drug world and the incarceration world. I felt that I could do a really good job of, you know, trying to bridge that gap between people who use drugs, people who are impacted by incarceration, and then government and lawmakers.
Right. So that's the work you do today. I want to talk a little bit more just briefly about your time in prison, right? Like, because this also feeds into the work that you do now, but from a very different point of view. Talk a little bit about the challenges in that. Like, did you get treatment when you were in the Department of Corrections?
So I did not receive treatment while I was in the Department of Corrections, and I was even taken off of the medication for opioid use disorder that I had been on when I went into incarceration. So I was actually receiving less treatment when I went into the prison. And that's a really common story that you hear. It's becoming less common. Director Thornell is doing a good job of beginning to expand the medication for opioid use disorder program. But it was a struggle. I would come home, and, you know, the reason I went back multiple times was because throughout those times that I was incarcerated, I wasn't learning anything new. I was just having a dry break from substances and then coming home and doing the same. Mm. And there was one time that I'd come home, I was still pretty young, and I actually ended up overdosing in the parking lot of the Department of Corrections. Wow. And had to be rushed to the hospital by my husband, who thankfully saved my life. But that is just a testament to the need for better treatment, because people are coming home in similar mindsets. You know, nothing's changed. They have no new tools in their toolkit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that, I want to ask you about some news on that front, right? Because there's been some controversy over this, but the state says it's using a big chunk of the opioid settlement money over the opioid abuse crisis and overdose crisis we've been seeing over the last decade here. Some of that money will be going to state prisons. How do you feel about that? Because, like I said, it's been controversial.
So it has definitely been controversial, and I have taken a lot of time to think about it. I think on one hand, it's great that the current administration is showing that combating the overdose crisis is somewhat of a priority. But on the other hand, I think that it's going to be imperative that we're ensuring that this money is really going to the right things. Mm. We currently have the massive lawsuit that's been going on with the Department of Corrections for many, many years. And there are a lot of concerns that some of that money is going to be used to kind of backfill some of those things rather than actually going towards what it's intended to do, which is to help with the opioid crisis. So I would say I am cautiously optimistic. At Arizonans for Transparency and Accountability in Corrections, a huge portion of what we do is trying to ensure that there is accountability within the department. So we will be watching very, very closely to see where those funds are being allocated, how they're being used, and we'll definitely be coming forward if we find that they aren't being used in a way that aligns with our vision for the goals.
But it really sounds like you think that there is an opportunity, at least in corrections, to use those funds really well and, like, give people the kind of treatment you did not get.
I do. I absolutely think that there is an opportunity for the funds to be used well. But again, historically, we have seen that the department doesn't spend money in ways that are beneficial to the people who are incarcerated. So mm-hmm. We'll see.
I want to talk to you about some good news on this front, which is rare. There's been a lot of reporting of late that the deaths resulting from overdose have really seemed to plummeted in much of the country. What do you make of that? Like, is that true in your experience? Do you have any feelings as to why that would be happening? Because a lot of researchers seem to be relatively puzzled as to how this could have happened and how we keep it going.
So I think it's incredible. I think that any time we are lowering the numbers of preventable deaths is always an incredible thing. I think harm reduction organizations that are popping up all across the country, led by people who use drugs, led by people who have experience in this area, are playing a huge role. Access to syringe service programs, access to education through a lot of those harm reduction organizations. I think a lot of it is just based on that education piece. And from what I'm seeing, there are areas that we are seeing significant drops. But what we're hearing is that there are still a lot of areas where people are severely disadvantaged. A lot of minority communities or poverty-ridden communities, their numbers are still raising. Mm. So we're seeing numbers drop as a total, but there are still areas that need addressed. Specifically in Arizona, our indigenous community is very, very heavily hit by the overdose crisis. So I'm hoping that we can move into those areas so that we can start to see those drops that are happening in some areas happen everywhere.
So let me ask you a little bit about what you'd like to see change still. You talked about the things that worked for you, right? Some of those have been put into place pretty, you know, pretty broadly in our state, not all of them. What policies do you think should be adopted at this point to keep these good trends going and maybe to get into some of those communities you're more concerned about, like you mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a lot of things that we can do, but if I'm looking at, you know, things that could be implemented in the immediate that could have a very quick impact, that first thing would be supervised consumption sites that would allow people to use in a safe area, not in the public, where they're under the care of a medical doctor or a nurse, and then they would have the opportunity to be connected with resources, services, or treatment. Mm-hmm. And then also, earlier this year, we saw some changes to the federal regulations surrounding methadone. And these were done off of studies that showed that by giving people more privileges and less really, really intense hurdles to go over, that people were having higher success rates. And this was studied during COVID. So these regulations have changed, but each individual state and then the medical clinics within each state have the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to implement those. Hmm. And it's going to be imperative that here in Arizona we implement those changes so that we can be at the forefront of ending the overdose crisis here.
One of the things that I always think is interesting in these kind of conversations is the sort of tension between allowing people to use drugs, right, in a supervised setting when it's an illegal thing. Like, mm-hmm. how do you convince people that's a good idea, that's not just enabling them to do it?
So I think that a lot of people base their morality in legality. And obviously, we don't want a lot of people out committing crimes. But at its core, people are going to do drugs regardless. We should be ensuring that just from an empathy perspective, people are using safely and we're keeping them healthy, you know, until they get to a point that they maybe decide to go to treatment or maybe decide that there's an area of recovery that works better for them. And I think also there are tons of studies out there that have shown that, you know, people who go to supervised consumption sites, there was one that was done, I believe, based on the two sites that had opened in New York. And there was like 30% of the people who went to the clinic ended up seeking additional treatment. Mm,
they were connected in that way.
Yep. Yeah. So by going to these sites, people are connected to resources that they wouldn't have if they were just using in an alleyway. It's giving people a safe place where they can find resources, they can use safely. They're not catching hepatitis C or HIV. And then eventually they can go back home to their families.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll leave it there for now. Jay Alexandria Garcia, Policy Director at Arizonans for Transparency and Accountability in Corrections, Digital Community Organizer for DREAM.org, as well as Research Consultant at the University of Arizona's Harm Reduction Lab. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for telling us your story and your point of view here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. John Fugelsang is a comedian and radio host who's dedicated his career to skewering politicians. He built an early reputation as a fierce critic of the George W. Bush administration, appearing on shows like Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher and The Daily Show. These days, he hosts a radio show on Sirius XM and tours the country doing stand-up. He'll be at the Arizona Financial Theater this weekend as part of the Stephanie Miller's Sexy Liberals Save the World tour. As Fugelsang told the show's Sam Dingman, politicians come and go, but his approach to political comedy remains the same.
You know, there's one big rule I have for comedy, governance, and Christianity, and that's you don't punch down. With Kamala Harris, you're going after someone who is a woman, someone who is a mixed race person, and someone who is breaking a lot of boundaries. So it's kind of hard to make fun of her. You could go after her in terms of her policy positions. You could go after her because, oh, before you wanted to ban plastic straws. Now you don't care if the ducks suffocate. You know, there's a lot of ways you can go. But on a comedic level, I think most people are focused on the election right now. Donald Trump is a much easier target. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean he's been good for comedy, by the way. There's been a lot of terrible comedy because of Donald Trump. And every comedian I talk to is bloody well sick of the man, I will tell you this. I never run out of material with him, but I think once Kamala Harris assumes office, then her policy positions, like Bill Clinton's, will be up for grabs for comics. Unlike Bill Clinton, she's not as easy to make fun of.
Yeah, yeah. What for you is the most interesting angle to take on Trump right now? As you were just mentioning, there's nearly a decade, just when we think about his political career, of jokes that have been made, and there's a fatigue that has set in. What is the most vital angle for you?
For me personally, and it's just for me, I'm endlessly fascinated by the subject of Donald Trump and Christianity. Mm-hmm. As someone who comes from an abnormally Christian background, raised by two former clergy who once promised God I would never happen, I filter everything through a New Testament filter. And I'm a big fan of pointing out the difference between what Jesus actually said and what his various unauthorized fan clubs like to believe he said. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's endlessly funny to look at people who call themselves followers of Jesus, but they vote for Cuomo over Caligula. I mean, the only thing Donald Trump has in common with Jesus is they both spent a lot of time with prostitutes and they both use ghostwriters. So to me, it's endlessly funny because anyone who thinks that Donald Trump and Jesus have anything in common ideologically hasn't read either one of their books.
Do you think of yourself as a comedian first and foremost?
I do. A few years ago, I was working on CNN, and one morning we were interviewing Mitt Romney's communications director, and I said to him, how are you guys going to go back to the middle for a general after going so far to the right to beat Newt Gingrich in a primary campaign? And he said, oh, you just shake the Etch-a-Sketch. It's like an Etch-a-Sketch. And by the time I got home, that story had gone viral around the world, and I had caused the first scandal of the Romney campaign. But throughout my career, as I've worked at cable news stations, I've always made it known I do not pretend to be a journalist. If I were to do that, I'd go work for Fox.
Uh-huh. But you have, sorry, it took me a second on that one. But you have, over the course of your comedy career, kept the news close, kept politics and issues close.
Always.
What is it about keeping that as a primary register of your comedy that continues to be appealing to you, even as you don't identify as of that world?
That is such a great question, because I first came out to Hollywood when I was very young to host America's Funniest Home Videos, which I did for a couple of seasons. And it was very high profile. It was very good money. Mm-hmm. And I was deeply unhappy. And my agents were thrilled that I had booked this job. And it taught me that my definition of success was not the same as my agents and managers. My dad had been a history teacher. So growing up, being engaged in politics and American history was a way to earn his love, like normal guys would with sports. So that's always been a focus of mine. I've always had a passion for current events and for trying to find ways to take current events and make them funny. For so many of us, we glaze over what's going on. And I find humor is often the most effective delivery system for truth or facts.
Yeah, that's so interesting, the idea of earning love through having an interesting perspective on history or the news or politics. Because a huge part of the comedian's job is to earn the love of the audience. So it makes sense to me that those things would be fused together. Do you ever find, though, that your audience or the audience of the Sexy Liberal Save the World comedy tour?
I play the role of tour on the Sexy Liberal tour, by the way, but yes.
So one of the things that, you know, was a kind of a striking moment for me recently was when Kamala Harris went into the Penzi Spices outside Pittsburgh and met with some supporters. And one of them was just crying because she was so scared about the possible outcome of the election.
Oh, come here! What is that about? What is that about?
I think you understand. I'm pretty sure you know.
Oh, it's gonna be good. We're gonna be good. We're gonna be fine. We're gonna be fine. We are all in this together.
Yes, we are.
We're gonna be fine.
We are.
I know that people have always been worried that their preferred side is going to lose, but it does seem like there is a little bit more existential dread this cycle on both sides than there has been previously. And do you find when you're addressing an audience that is something that you're up against and have to take into account in your material, that people don't just need to laugh, they need like a reason to believe it's all going to be okay?
Yes. And that's been one of the interesting things about our tour this year. Mm-hmm. I understand that existential dread a lot of folks have, because people grew up with a certain idea of America, and now they're realizing America is going to maybe reelect this racist game show host who stole from vets with a fraud online university and a fraud charitable foundation. I get the despair. And I try to remind people that at this point, and I'm sorry for being so nakedly partisan, but at this point, despair is privilege. If you're psyched out, if you're down, I understand, take a break from news for the day, but then get back in the game because your democracy needs you.
Well, let's imagine for a moment that Kamala Harris does win the election, but then does not shake the Etch-a-Sketch, does end up governing more from the center. Could you envision a version of yourself that would then, to whatever extent, more centrist, perhaps even somewhat Republican policies offend your values, starting to be harder on her? And if you ended up doing that, would you worry about the reaction of your fans?
Well, not if it's funny. That's the trick. You know, Billy Wilder said, if you're going to tell people the truth, make it funny or they'll kill you. Jesus taught me the joys of mocking pious hypocrites. In my sense, I've got to make sure that I attach a punchline so it doesn't become tiresome and preachy.
All right. Well, John Fugelsang is a comedian and SiriusXM radio host, and he will be at the Arizona Financial Theater this weekend with Stephanie Miller's Sexy Liberals Save the World comedy tour. John, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure, Sam. Thanks for all you do.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Some of the most famous works of land art are here in the Southwest. James Turrell's Rodin Crater in northern Arizona's Painted Desert, or City by Michael Heiser in central eastern Nevada. Massive works like these have been influential in the art world. But today, the conversation around land art in general is changing. As a recent piece in High Country News points out, land art in the era of land acknowledgments and conversations about the land back movement is something of a conundrum. What does it mean to imprint the earth and call it art when indigenous people have been doing that for centuries? Well, our next guest this morning has a different take on what land art can be. Cristobal Martinez is creative director of ASU's School of Art and a member of the artist collective Post Commodity. His version of land art doesn't necessarily have to permanently alter the land. In 2015, Post Commodity created a work called Repellent Fence, a miles-long line of floating balloons that stretched across the U.S.-Mexico border in southern Arizona. It only stayed up for 4 days. I spoke with Martinez more about what land art means today and how it's changing.
A lot of times when people think about land art, they think about these iconic figures in art. And these figures are canonical. And there are artists that include Michael Heiser, Robert Smithson, Nancy Holt, James Turrell. And we oftentimes think of their work when land art is sort of called to mind. And these artists have demonstrated a history of altering land in a large scale manner as a way to create art. And so at the time that a lot of these artists were up to doing this work, many of them did have a sense of wanting to draw attention to natural ecologies and were interested in thinking about land preservation. But the contradiction, of course, embedded in a lot of their work is that what they did do in their work was they altered the land and intervened or created interventions onto the land that irrevocably altered natural ecology. And so even though some of the artist's intentions were to draw our attention to and bring us into relationship with natural ecologies and land, and to be situated and to be mindful, they also created this irreconcilable dilemma where the artworks themselves actually contradicted in many ways the message or the situation that they were trying to create for audiences.
I want to ask you specifically about this idea of land art of that kind or earthwork in that way, right? In the age of land acknowledgments, right? Like if we're saying often in culture today, like we know we're on this land that has belonged for millennia to these indigenous peoples, like what does it mean to alter that land, but also to sort of lay claim to it in that way?
Yes, yeah, so the meaning of these works is shifting. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you try to contextualize land art of this era, it suddenly takes on a new meaning, and these meanings are problematic. And it's a complex question to ask because it's been noted by indigenous peoples that land acknowledgments in and of themselves are also problematic. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of have like a stacked set of problems. The land acknowledgement itself is problematic, while at the same time, this land artwork situated within a time of land acknowledgement is problematic on top of that, because it doesn't actually function in any way, oftentimes does not function as a land acknowledgement in and of itself, and it couldn't, because it has created destruction onto the land. And so I think that the question you're asking, it's a problematizing question. Hmm. And I think it's an important question because it leads to us having capacity for evaluating and understanding and thinking about this art in ways that perhaps it wasn't originally intended, which I think is good, a good thing. But it also could lead to opportunities for deeper education around art and contemporary art and future directions for contemporary art, which would be more able to represent, to support a larger variety of human experiences.
Right, right. So let's talk about what that would look like and this idea of land art in a different way, thinking about it in a different way. Like you say, it doesn't necessarily need to be something that permanently alters the land, right? And you've participated in projects that do this differently. Tell us about Repellent Fence, this project you did in 2015, and the way that used land in a very different kind of sense.
Okay, so I'm an artist in the collective Post-Commodity, and Repellent Fence is a work of Post-Commodity. Mm-hmm. And together we collaborated with the cities of Douglas, Arizona, and Agua Prieta, Sonora, to create a 2-mile-long ephemeral monument, land mm-hmm. artwork, that was lifted and intersecting the U.S.-Mexico border with 1 mile in the United States and 1 mile in Mexico, over the duration of 4 days. The idea was to create a metaphor where all stakeholders within the region could see themselves a part of. And so it was a generative metaphor, a metaphor that it was not a protest. It was a metaphor that allowed a diversity of people, of a diversity of stakeholders at the U.S.-Mexico border to see themselves in, regardless of their political views on the border, in order to come together in a highly diplomatic, generative, and productive way to think a little bit about the meaning of the border. Mm-hmm. So it was a land artwork that was essentially a tool for knowing.
Right.
And so the idea of creating something ephemeral, something that would be up for a few days and then go away, was to establish, not to mark the land, not to try to claim genius to an idea, but to catalyze a peaceful and respectful conversation about what it meant to be alive and living in that particular region of the world.
It sounds like it was a really collaborative process as well. And you described it in this beautiful way that I want to ask you about, that it lives on as a public memory, even though it was something that only right. was there for a couple of days. Talk about what that meant and what you hope it meant, I guess.
I think what it meant is that art can be something much greater. And we know this. Many of us in the field know this. So it's not an epiphany or anything. It's not a revelation of any sort. It's that we understand that art is much, much greater than mere commodity. Mm-hmm. In that we would not try to, as a collective, as an indigenous collective, we were not interested in commodifying the land. Mm-hmm. And so it provides a working example of what art can be and do in the world within the genre of land art or within any kind of art at all. So when we get to do things like that, it leads to new ways of thinking, new ways of valuing, new ways of doing, and new ways of believing.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Cristobal Martinez joining us, creative director and professor at ASU School of Art, co-director of the School of Art with director Forrest Hulise as well, as a member of the artist collective Post Commodity. Cristobal, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for talking to us about this and your work and your role in it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
As part of our Last Resorts series, we thought it would be fun to see what architectural elements from Phoenix's iconic resort past still exist.
From all over the world come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
Today's hidden gem is the Camelback Inn Chapel. Very modest in size, it would be easy to miss this piece of the resort's history. The show's Sativa Peterson met up with Scott Jarson, a longtime realtor in town who specializes in architecturally unique properties. The two walked around the structure, which remains relatively unchanged some 85 years later.
Today we're at the Camelback Inn. It's a ubiquitous desert inn that has morphed through the years, and we're at a very unique structure on the property. It's one of the few structures here that date back to the early beginnings of the resort, and it's right up by the valet where you check in. But it's the chapel. It was built in 1938, and it's a stone structure. It's really organic in nature. It's modest in size. It's built out of native Arizona rock. There's little pieces of copper ore embedded into the rock here and there. But it's a wonderful small space, and it just has a piece of history. It just says a little Arizona structure in the desert. Sure, like a lot of people who visit Arizona or those of us who have grown up here, we've all been coming to the Camelback Inn for decades, and we've seen it more from a more traditional sort of adobe structure into some 70s and even 2000 updates. But this structure has always remained the same. The walls, the integrity of the structure have been the same since 1938. And it's overlooked. You kind of come in and you get drawn into the grand scheme of the resort. But here it is, this little piece of history still intact. It's very modest in size, maybe 16 by 16. Nice low ceilings. And we happen to be here on a summer day. It's very, very comfortable, even though there's not a lick of air conditioning in here. But it was a structure that wasn't meant to be inhabited. I think it was a place of reflection. And maybe at some point, maybe a light place of worship, but it's not large enough to hold any kind of big events in here. Here's a little piece that they can preserve unchanged that doesn't have a specific use. In other words, it's not a dining room, it's not a guest room. It can remain as it was. And I think it really does lure and hearken the visitors back to a time when this was a desert place. And you'd come here to interact with things like native stone and small hand-built spaces. So I think it serves a number of purposes, and one is a great little surprise for the visitors who might be strolling to the parking lot and say, hey, what's that building? I know I've had a lot of friends through the years. We'd come for brunch, and I'd say, let me show you my favorite part of Camelback Inn. As we've grown up, these desert resorts have either gone away or they've morphed into something a little more complex. But if you go back to the beginnings, when people would come here for the dry climate, for just a solitary sort of adventure in the desert. This is what they were expecting, and this is what you get in these little structures. The desert's all around us, so we do hear the birds, and we're in a heavily landscaped place with beautiful cactus specimens, but what we're hearing is the nature interacting with those. What I do love about it is a little funky. There's not a lot of, capital A architecture here. This is obviously hand-built. It harkens back a little to sort of Victorian follies, where people would build something maybe out of scale, but from a distance it looked like a ruined castle, that sort of thing. So to some extent, I feel like this is a little folly in the desert, and it just shows hand of the maker, which I love too. You can see the grout lines where somebody obviously built this. This wasn't a big crew. This is probably two or three people really honoring this little building. Our desert is very special, but it's a harsh environment. And having a respite from the sun, from the heat of the day, or even the chill of the night is something that's almost primal. And you see it in a lot of good desert architecture. And this structure is kind of one of those. It's a sense of shelter the minute you walk into it. You're out of the sun, and you're still connected to the earth.
That was Scott Jarson, realtor and founder of the real estate firm Jarson & Jarson. If you want to check it out, the Camelback Inn Chapel is located right next to the valet stand where guests check in. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.